Welcome. This is episode 2 of the Brooklyn Game Podcast. The first one was way too long ago, and we talked with Ryan Eagle of the YES Network, the voice of the Nets. And we have another voice of the Nets here with us today, the other play-by-play commentator, Ryan Rugo, who is also from ESPN New York and another voice of the YES Network. Ryan, how are you doing today?
You know, I'm just – I got to try and live up to the Ryan Eagle hype again, man. Don't I try and do this enough?
Look, this is your life now. You can't say – you have to accept it as part of something you have to do. You are with Ryan Eagle in this life.
Oh, my gosh. I guess so. You know, can we make it a little bit easier rather than trying to follow up perhaps the best play-by-play guy in the country, man? My gosh.
Okay, you can follow up on Jim Spinarco. How about that? How's that work?
All right, sounds good. That's perfect. Jim's my man. That's good to go. We went on plenty of nice lunches in Utah and Portland and on the West Coast.
Yeah, you guys had quite a trip out there. I mean, they did too. And it was the eight-game, 17-day circus road trip. I was stuck in Brooklyn, and I went to Barclays Center a few times, and it was just completely hounded with people, and there was the circus, and there were, you know, PETA protests against Barclays Center and against Wrigley. I'm sure it was a lot more fun on the road. What was it like doing that kind of road trip where you had to go from place to place, and be away from home for, you know, much more than usual?
You know what? I loved it. I love the travel. I'm also, you know, in my 20s and single, so I don't have a lot of the, you know, ties back home that, you know, some of the other guys do, whether it's the players or the announcers or, you know, members of the staff. You know, I don't have kids I have to worry about being away from or a wife or whatnot. So, you know, it's a little bit easier for me. I get a kick out of it. I always feel like it's, you know, it's fun bonding time. You know, I go to dinners, go to lunches with, you know, Chris Carino and Tim Capstraw and Spinarco and Fratello and, you know, our producers and whatnot. So, but the weird thing about NBA travel, and it's so much different than, say, baseball travel, is you really just duck in and out of these cities. I mean, rarely do you have more than a day and a half in any of these cities. And sometimes you only have half a day. Whereas, you know, when you do baseball travel, you have 3 or 4 days because it's a 3 or 4 game series. So you kind of get to know the city. You have some time. When it comes to NBA travel, it's, you know, it's one game. Save the postseason, you're there for one game. So it's really hopping in and out. Although I will say this, Devin, I thought that this was the perfect time for the trip as far as just overall happiness goes, because when it's still cold in New York around mid-March, it starts to get depressing because your expectation is that it will be warming up. And when it's not, that's when I think the cold really starts to bother you. So the fact that, you know, we were out west and, you know, pretty much every place we went was beautiful, because even, you know, Portland was beautiful when we were there, and Denver and Utah, you know, in addition to Arizona and L.A., which were the obvious choices. Because of that, I actually thought it was well-timed.
Yeah, I was going to say, because, I mean, I'm here in Brooklyn most of the time. I'll travel a little regionally, but for the most part, like, one of the things that hit me more than anything else was leaving Barclays Center at night, and it's 9 degrees outside.
Brutal.
That's a big thing for players too. I mean, right? I mean, like, when your job is a night job for the most part, or at least, you know, you're going to be playing in a certain place 41 times a year. You want to feel comfortable. And I mean, you know, you saw Ray Allen went to Miami for 2 years to win a championship and be in 80 degree weather. And you come back, you know, mid March it's still pretty cold, and you come back and say like it's going to be 70 later this week. Like, that's just like a good time to like leave the place and allow it to get warm without you. And then you come back and it's like, oh, this is starting to get a little more comfortable again. So yeah, I think the players probably feel that way too. Although, I mean,
you
I'm sure what? It might just be you, right?
Yeah, I think it probably is more me, because I think by the end of that road trip, those guys were pretty ready to get back home. But at least that was I thought, a pretty noticeable silver lining in a 13-day road trip, was being in warmth when it was cold back home.
I know you said you were there for, like, you're only there for about a day and a half or a day for each one, but did you have a favorite city along the way?
I thought, you know, Dallas was great. Dallas was great. It was beautiful both days we were there. We also stayed there the night after the win, and that's always just creates kind of a, you know, fun atmosphere, because everybody is a little giddy after a victory, right? So, and it was a big win in Dallas. It was nice weather. It's still got, you know, there's a lot to do there. You can walk different places. It was beautiful. But I'll tell you what, too, man. I mean, I'd never been to Portland. That city, we got a gorgeous day. It didn't rain, which I know is normally what goes on there. But that city was really cool. And Utah, we didn't have a ton of time there because we got in late from Denver, you know, and then we had the game the next day. But Salt Lake City is gorgeous with the mountains and that. I'll give the victory to Dallas. Now, remember, I wasn't on the L.A.-Arizona portion of the trip. Had I been,
right?
Those are the two cities I missed. Had I been, I'm sure those would have been one and two in the power rankings for the road trip cities. But instead, I'll give it to Dallas for the cities I participated in.
I'm glad that you mentioned every city but Detroit. I think that's pretty fun.
Well, you know, I will tell you this. Sometimes you plot out, okay, what is the city where I'm not going to leave the hotel room? And, you know, that one was Detroit. Although we, you know, there are some really nice different areas of Detroit suburbs and that, you know, like Birmingham, so to speak. But it was freezing and raining, and we had half a day there. And so room service and game prep sounded like the best path through Detroit.
Ryan, that's why you're the guy. That's why you're the one who's going on these trips. You know what?
I will tell you this, though, Devin. I mean, my favorite music artist is Eminem. So, I mean, I have some, like, emotional ties to Detroit because of that. So
that's fair.
You know.
That's fair. I mean, it's Eminem knows what he's doing. He did come from D. I have a lot of good friends in Detroit. I just occasionally like making fun of it.
Well, you know what? Some of that comes with, like, our New York arrogance, too. So.
Oh, totally.
You know, we like to, like, you live there? That's a cute place to live. I live in New York. You know, I mean, that's kind of like what us New Yorkers do.
Yeah, and I think that applies to pretty much every city in the country.
Yeah, I think we feel that way basically about everywhere. I would agree.
Although, to be fair, I've gone down to Miami a couple of times in the last few months, and I could get used to Miami in the winter as opposed to New York, just as far.
Yeah, like, I totally agree. I could see the logic behind leaving New York on January 2nd and not returning to, like, you know, April 1st. And if you go someplace like Miami, there's definitely some logic behind that.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad we spent the first 10 minutes talking about the weather. This is what everyone is waiting for.
Yeah, absolutely. Just typical conversationalists, you know.
Yeah, but yeah, let's talk a little about the basketball team that both of us tend to watch kind of often, the Brooklyn Nets. Now, most recently, they played the Chicago Bulls Thursday night, and this is being recorded Saturday morning. I think I'm going to put it up this afternoon for those of you who are curious, but it might go up after the Bobcats game. But in any case, the most recent game we've seen play is Chicago Bulls, which was just a heartbreaker. Ryan, what was your perspective on, you know, that last minute of the game, how it kind of led up to that point? What did you see? What did you see on the court for the Nets?
Well, here's the thing. I thought that was the most painful loss of the season. I wouldn't call it the worst loss because, you know, I think the game in Philadelphia was a worse loss. I think the home game on St. Patrick's Day against Atlanta was a worse loss where they played worse. I just thought this was the most painful because it was clear that the guys wanted this game. You know, you're playing an undermanned Bulls team. You're at home for the first time in a long time. And, you know, you're playing some great stretches of basketball within the game. But, you know, here's the thing. I thought what you saw is kind of the good and the bad of this team. You know, the bad is they have not been stout enough defensively throughout this season. There's not enough consistency on the defensive end of the floor. And I think that's what you saw in the second half. You know, they didn't know how to defend Carlos Boozer. They couldn't get consistent stops. And because of that, Chicago was able to wipe away, you know, a 16-point deficit, 11, you know, at halftime, very quickly because the Nets couldn't get consistent enough stops to stem the tide. The good, and I think this is something that will be beneficial in the postseason, is it's really difficult to keep the Nets from getting buckets on those focused half-court possessions because you have three guys who you really can't guard one-on-one. You know, two of them were hitting their shots in the fourth quarter, and Darren and Joe, and the other one, Brooke, had some great looks, just didn't go down for him. But I think that is the most unique aspect of this Nets team that translates to postseason play, is a lot of these teams don't have you know, two guys who can't be guarded one-on-one. The Nets really have three guys who can't be guarded one-on-one. And I thought you saw, you know, the positives of that. As far as the last minute goes, Devin, I thought, you know, Deron Williams was in takeover mode, total takeover mode. And the final two possessions I have no problem with because you give the ball to Deron Williams, you let him make plays. He made the decision to dish to Brook under the hoop. Brook should have gone up stronger against Muhammad. He didn't, but it was a great look and a good feed from Deron. On the final shot, would I prefer Deron take a floater? Yeah, because I felt like he was in one of those zones where I wanted him shooting, but I can't knock a guy for breaking down someone off the dribble and kicking to a wide-open person he trusts in a jump shot area where he hits often, you know? So the only possession that I think was really regrettable was the turnover by Brook, where I thought, you know, ball hadn't really gone into him in the post for most of the fourth quarter, and just asking him to be the facilitator of sorts on that possession, I would have rather just keep it in the hands of Deron and let him make plays like they did on the last two possessions, even though they came up empty.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, look, the thing about Deron in those last couple of places, you know, one of the criticisms that you can have of the Nets late-game offense, that I've had late-game offense, I should say, is that they're very predictable and very stagnant. It's give the ball to Joe or, in some cases, Deron, and just get the hell out of the way and let them do something. And in this case, in a lot of cases, what ends up happening is that Joe Johnson will take a fadeaway jumper. And amazingly, they work most of the time.
In this case,
you saw, you know, Deron drew and Nazir Muhammad, and Brook was wide open, and he made the instinctual basketball play to get his open man the shot. And if you talk to coaches like, you know, Greg Popovich or Scott Brooks or even Tom Thibodeau, the best guys in the game, the crunch time offense is not, you know, that crazy. It's get the ball to the guy who's open and let him shoot.
Yes.
And that's
exactly
what the Nets did. And I think,
totally,
you know, I agree with you that I think Deron had maybe a better look than, you know, he could have gotten a nice floater off. I think he's done really well shooting that floater this year. But, you know, I'm with you on those last two possessions. They're the smart thing to do. And that turnover to me was the egregious part. And that's the thing. I mean, Joe Johnson said after the game, and we just wrote something about it, he said, you know, when Brooks in that situation, he thinks the guys are coming to double. And so he's trying to get the ball out of his hands as quickly as possible, but they're just faking, like they're just trying to get him off this game. And so that's something I think he needs to work on. You know, as far as Wolkes goes, because I do want to talk a little more about him. You know, it's his first season as an All-Star. I mean, you had a chance to see in the last couple of years now. I mean, obviously not last year because of the injury, but what have you seen out of Lopez this year? What do you think has changed in his game? Why do you think he's been able to kind of, you know, become this All-Star player?
So, here's the thing. I think with Brook Lopez this year, he became more aware of his strength, of his size, of his ability. And I think when you play with great players like Deron and Joe, and you see you can do those things with them, it gives you confidence. When you make an all-star game and you're around greatness, I think it gives you confidence. So I think that really it's a player who's always had ability but now fully understands, oh, wow, I belong on this level. And I give Deron credit, too, for some of Brook's confidence, because even last year, you know, Deron kept saying over and over again, you know, Brook's the top five center in this league. If Brook was healthy, we'd be a playoff team. So he clearly knew that was there, and I think the combination of Deron's belief in him, Joe's belief in him, the coaching staff's belief in him, and then being around greatness, you see Brook really embracing that and understanding how good and talented he is. And I also think he's become a little bit more versatile, you know, offensively. Now we see him sometimes 18 feet out, put the ball on the floor, go strong to the hoop, and flush it down. I mean, he's had more ferocious dunks this year than I can remember in his first few years in this league. And I also think he's shown a little bit more of a left hand at times, or going left in the lane. And that gives a little bit more versatility, put something in the defender's head. So, you know, all of that, I just think he really, you know, he's come into his own. And he's only 25. I still think he's going to get better, too, because this year we've also seen strides on the defensive end. He's not there yet, but he's a heck of a lot better than he used to be on that end of the floor.
Yeah, I mean, that's actually something I think is surprising, is that, you know, one of the biggest criticisms about Brook was that he couldn't defend anyone. And to some degree, I mean, he's not Dwight, or he's not, you know, Marcus Saul or anybody like that, but he's gotten to a point where I think he's what I've said it a few times, patently average, which is just a huge step up from what he was in years past. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, Yeah, I think that's, you know what, I think that's a good description. And you know what, that's when you combine that with how great he is offensively, I mean, that's a really good player. And you consider that, you know, it should be encouraging that he's gotten better in both areas, because you think, okay, if he's improved, then can he still pick up? And I think he really can, especially on the defensive end.
Hey, we talked about greatness and playing around greatness, and that makes me think, of course, of Darren. And, you know, when Darren and Joe were both struggling to start the year, Brooke was the guy who was consistently night in and night out producing. And, you know, when he got injured and went down for about 7 games, that led to a coaching change. I mean, they had
yes, it did.
Put 5, and then a week later, you know, PJ was coaching. But before we get into that, as far as Darren goes, because Darren has looked like a different person from February 18th or whatever that first day was to today. And, I mean, you saw it on Thursday night. I mean, he was unbelievable down the stretch against the Chicago Bulls. You can talk about his, you know, his detoxifying cleanse, or you can talk about the platelet burst. But, like, as far as on the court, like, what have you seen in Darren that makes it, that seems so different, that's kind of made him a different player before the All-Star break to now?
Well, I think that on the floor, there is sort of that takeover ability, if you will, that we've seen. You know, he really, at times, has just, you know, taken hold of a game and said, no, we're going to win tonight. And I don't know that we saw that in the beginning of the season, whether it was because of physical abilities or, you know, a lack of confidence, partially because of his physical deficiencies, whatever it was. You know, we didn't see a guy who was capable of just taking over games. And right now, I think he has an awareness where he just needs to take over. And I think the example of that where it is, you know, most proficient is in Dallas. Now, you're right. In Chicago, against Chicago the other night, he did do this. But, you know, they ended up losing. But, yeah, he was the reason they were going to win that game if they did. He took control of that fourth quarter. But in Dallas, in the beginning of the fourth quarter, in that game, the offense got stagnant. Nothing was working. You know, he wasn't getting much help from the other guys on the floor with him at the beginning of that fourth quarter. And you could tell he was just like, all right, I'm going to have to do it myself. And he did. And he hits jumper after jumper. And you could just tell in his rhythm and the way he's dribbling that he's just feeling it. And he made sure to preserve the lead. And then finally, when they got back in rhythm, they ended up expanding the lead and they go on to a big-time double-digit win over the Mavs. But you could tell he realized, I'm going to have to do it right now. And he was able to. And I think the thing that allows him to, on the court-wise, more than anything, is he has that explosive step back. I mean, he's blowing by guys again. Earlier this year, it felt like he could only really probe. Right now, he is just getting right past people. I mean, look at that final possession of the game against Chicago. You know, he was drawing the help from Muhammad in seconds. They only had 5 seconds to work with. He blew by his defender immediately. You know, even Jimmy Butler in those final few possessions, who's a really good defender. You know, Luol Deng got switched up on him a couple times. You know, whether it was Nate Robinson, none of them could take his speed. And so for me, the number one reason why he's been playing the way that he has is his speed. Now, his shot has gotten better, no doubt about it, but that wasn't enough. You know, because he's not always going to get, you know, those set-up open jumpers off the ball. Sometimes he's going to need to have the defense respect his speed. And now that they do, they have a decision to make. Do I go up and crowd him and risk him blowing by me, or do I give him the space and risk him dropping in a three? You know, and then if he does blow by me, someone else is coming to help and somebody else is open. Plus, he's shown the ability to explode and finish around the rim. More than anything else, though, it's all from that speed which he has back. And, I mean, to me, it's not just him looking like a top 2 or 3 point guard again. It's him looking like a top 10 player.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's funny because, you know, when ESPN did the NBA rank last couple of years, and I was involved in that. I'm not sure if you were, but they ranked B-Will as a top 10 player in these last couple of years. And I don't think he's really played to that level in the last couple of years. But since the All-Star break and since all this, you know, his quickness has come back, you know, he really has looked like, you know, he's been the MVP of his team since then, like, without question.
No question.
And that's like, and given how well, you know, Brooklyn has been playing this year and how, you know, how much he's developed, just to be able to say without equivocation, you know, Darren Williams is a superstar again, it's just, it's very different from the last couple of years. And it's just, it's like watching a new player almost completely reborn. And I remember when you and I, like the first game that Brian and I watched together, for those of you who are listening, was the Nets, I believe it was against the Wizards, when Darren set the record for 3-pointers and a half. With
yeah.
nine, and we fell apart. At least I was falling apart.
Oh my gosh, what is going on? Yeah, pretty much that. Yeah.
And the thing is that the Wizards were playing off of him because they knew, like even John Wall knew that they couldn't stay in front of Darren. So he had all of these open looks because of that, because that's, you know, part of it was because that speed was just terrifying, and part of it was just because Darren Williams went nuts and just hit 12 threes,
yeah.
whatever it was.
Oh, and you know what, too, Devin? He's so versatile in the way that he can score, too. Like, Darren, he doesn't need the ball in catch-and-shoot situations to hit his threes. He is excellent pulling up off the dribble. He could be doing it just like a little setup dribble, or he could be doing it in transition off the dribble. Then, you know, he's good fading away after backing his man down in the post. You know, he's been good with those runners. He's finishing around the rim. Right now, he really basically can do it all. And I think about the NBA playoffs, you think about guys who can take over games. And I look at the Eastern Conference. Let's take Miami out of it with LeBron and Wade. You know, outside
yep.
of that, you know, is there a player you have more confidence in taking over a game than Darren Williams? You might say Carmelo Anthony.
I'd say Carmelo, yeah. That's about
yep.
it.
And you probably would. And other than Melo, you'd say Darren Williams. And that guy is on your team as you enter the postseason, and I think that's so crucial. And if you look at his postseason numbers in Utah, they are bonkers. Like, we haven't really gotten a chance to assess that yet because we didn't have a reason to look at that his first year and a half, you know, with the Nets. But now, you know, Nets fans, as they get ready for the postseason, go look at those Darren Williams postseason numbers in Utah. They are crazy. His only time in the Western Conference Finals, even though they lost in five games to the Spurs, his numbers are through the roof, everything, across the board, his points, his steals, his assists, his shooting percentage from the floor, from three. So I think there's a lot to be excited about. And I think also, Devin, one more thing that needs to be mentioned about him, he's showing more emotion playing as well. His reaction on the and one the other night against the Bulls, that's the most emotion I've ever seen him show playing with this team, when he's pumping his right fist. And I think it's all a product of comfort and confidence, which he has a lot of right now.
Yeah, it's been really good to see. And I just took a look at his playoff numbers, and I'm also going to reiterate that you guys should go check them out because he looks pretty stellar.
Yeah, they're outstanding. They really are outstanding.
Yeah. I mean, let's talk about the playoffs for a little bit because we're, you know, only a couple weeks out. The Nets are kind of in a weird mode right now where they could either, if they play well, they'll hold on to the fourth seed and home court advantage, but there's also, and we've had this argument in the last day or so, there's also an argument to be made that what they should do is maybe rest some of their players and try to jockey for position for that sixth seed, because then it'd be easier for an easier road to the conference finals. What do you think the Nets should do, you know, heading into the playoffs? Do you think they should rest players? Do you think they should go all out and try to win the game, you know, as if it was, you know, the game one of the playoffs? What do you think is the best way for the Nets to enter the playoffs this year?
I think the number one priority is having your players ready for the postseason, and that encapsulates two things. One, health. Two, playing well and confident. So the first priority is making sure everybody is healthy. You know, back-to-backs, down the stretch, extended minutes, you play a double overtime game, only have one day off. There's no reason to push the guys' minutes the next game, even if it means losing that contest. No game any longer, no result is worth risking the health of any of your players. So that's priority number one. But number two is playing well. I think if you go in confident, that's key. You know, I don't really think you can be in a mode of trying to win games all season long and then trying to lose games. I think that'll form bad habits. I think it's a bad situation for you going into the postseason. To me, you want to be feeling good about the way you're playing basketball, and that is much more important than whatever opponent you're going to face. I also believe that, you know, the most important accomplishment for this team, the first thing they need to do is just get out of the first round. You know, to me, this season, the move to Brooklyn, everything is already a rousing success. You know, going to the postseason already creates a baseline of success. You know, the advancement to a second round would almost make it inarguable success, I think, for the first year here, even if you got bounced by the Heat in four games in the second round. but you really want to get out of it. And so then it's, okay, are you too concentrated on the conference finals? And then all of a sudden you're putting yourself in a worse position just to get there, because you're putting yourself in a worse position to get to the second round. You know, I think you take one thing at a time. You worry about getting your guys healthy, and you worry about playing good basketball, and you let the seeding take care of itself. Do I think you're probably better off, you know, at the 6 than the 5? Yeah, I think you probably are when you consider it. But are you better off with the 4 than the 5 or 6? Yes. I think the best case scenario at this point is being the 4 seed, you know, having home court advantage in that game 1 in Brooklyn in the first round, and potentially playing a game 7 at home. And then you deal with Miami when and if you get there.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think, you know, one kind of addition to that point is, like, you know, I think this team's potential, as I think every team's potential in these conferences, is getting to Miami. And whether you get to them in the second round of the conference finals, there's no shame in losing.
Yeah, exactly. It's all cosmetics then. You know what? I mean, if you drop to them in the second round or the conference finals, right? I mean, what would be worse is not getting out of the first round. That would be
right.
That would be worse than the discrepancy between losing to them in the second or in the Eastern Conference Finals.
And even though they've beaten Indiana twice this year, I still think Indiana is a tougher matchup for them than, say, if they played Atlanta with home court advantage. You know, like, if they played Indiana in the first round and had to win a couple of games in Indiana to get to the next round, I think that's a much more difficult path than, you know, having home court advantage against the Hawks or maybe the Bulls, because they definitely struggle with the Bulls. But I still think I agree with you that I think the smartest thing to do is win as much as possible, you know, rest guys when you need to, and then, you know, get that 4th seed and, you know, take care of business in the first round. And then, you know, that's like a stepping stone. You know, this is year 1 of Brooklyn.
You know why also, too, Devin, like, I feel like you want to go into the postseason with the feeling of accomplishment fresh in your mind. And I think that if you are trying to achieve the 4 seed here down the stretch and you don't, I mean, you're still going to have a clean slate going into the postseason, and you can regroup and regather and everything, but there may be a little bit of a feeling of, oh, man, because this team's already clinched the playoff spot. You know, that accomplishment is past them. The next one is wrapping up that 4 seed. That's important to them. And if you don't do that, there might be a little feeling of a down note as you get ready to the postseason, whereas if you do capture that, it's like, all right, you know, we've already accomplished another step. I think that sort of matters in the mentality as you get ready for the postseason.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I think that's definitely, I mean, you know, you want to feel like you've done something well, that you're like, you know, it's one thing to go into the, I mean, look, the last couple of years with the Nets, you know, watching them tank the last 10 games has just been excruciating. And I mean, this is, and if you're watching it, and it's one of those things where you're watching them jockey for position as opposed to play basketball, it's very, very different. You know, there's the incentive to want to play well and to watch good basketball as a, you know, as a writer, as a, you know, as a play-by-play announcer, as a fan, as anything, you know, you want to see a team play good basketball, and you don't want to see them kind of play the system. It's very, very different. So I agree with you in that case. As far as matchups go for the playoffs, I mean, what do you think are the best case and, I guess, the worst case? I mean, there's a good chance they'll either play, you know, Miami or, I'm sorry, Chicago or Atlanta in the first round, or if they fall down, they're going to play New York or Indiana. What do you think is the best case for this team to play in the first round? What do you think is the worst case? Where do you see the road? How do you see it unraveling or unfurling in the playoffs?
You know what's interesting is I really, truly believe they could beat any of those teams or lose to any of those teams. I know people look at Atlanta and they think that's a team the Nets couldn't lose to in the first round. And I would pick the Nets probably in 6 to win that series. But I would not be surprised if they lost to Atlanta, because Atlanta, in its 2 wins against the Nets, have given them real trouble. Their fast break points are like, I forget the exact numbers, but it's something like 90-20 in the 4 contests in favor of the Hawks. The Nets struggle with that a little bit. You know, Teague has had some big games against them, and they've struggled with the Al Horford, Josh Smith pick and roll. I still think when push comes to shove, the Nets are better, and I think also one of the things you don't have to deal with is a difficult atmosphere to play in on the road in the postseason, which is good. You know, that's one thing they wouldn't have to deal with if they played Atlanta. But I don't think that would be an easy series at all. I still think, however, of the opponents you could face, that probably the one that you're most comfortable with. Chicago, Indiana, New York, I feel sort of similarly about. I think that the Nets have a really good chance against all of those teams, and I don't think there's a huge difference between how you'd feel about their chances in a series against any of them, other than going up against Indiana or the Knicks guarantees a game seven on the road, and Chicago could be a game seven at home. You know, if Derrick Rose comes back, which I still don't think he's going to, but if he does, obviously that changes everything. And it could change it for the worse, too. You know, trying to integrate a player like that this late in the season isn't always a good thing. But I guess I would go, you know, the problem with I agree with you what you said about Indiana. There's some fear still, like, okay, you know, it's a playoff-tested team now a little bit. Have you really seen their best punch? You have beaten them twice, but they were kind of weird games. The first time you beat them, the Nets shot like 25 more free throws than the Pacers. You know, the second time you faced them, you didn't have Darren. So I'm not sure, you know, and they've been a good home team this year, the Pacers too. So game one and two in their building. I don't know. That'd be a tough series. The Knicks, I think that I think the Nets could easily, you know, beat the Knicks in a series. But I also think you want to see that first round against a team where going into Barclays Center, you're not worried about any, you know, noticeable faction of road fans. You know, you want that. It's all your team in the stands creating that first playoff game atmosphere in Brooklyn. Chicago is who I think they're going to play, Devin. I know I'm long-winded on this. I apologize, my man.
No, but
Chicago's who I think they're going to end up playing. And to me, that's a pick'em series. That's a really tough series because playing in the United Center is not easy at all. Chicago's been tough against them this year. But the one thing I will say is I think you'll have consistent close games because it's like a grinded out, tough style, sort of ugly it up. But the Nets know how to play that slow pace. You know, they don't have to be worried about being sped up. It's also kind of why they match up good with Indiana, I think. And push comes to shove, the Nets do have more guys who can do things in the half court offensively. The question is, can they get the stops that Chicago we know can? Ultimately, I'd probably pick the Nets in seven if they're the four seed in that series, but that would be a really tough series. I think it's the one we're going to get, too.
And I think one thing, another thing about potentially facing the Knicks, because I think people in New York probably want to see a Nets-Knicks series, but if you're facing the Knicks in the first round, you're guaranteeing a game one in Madison Square Garden and potentially a game seven in Madison Square Garden, and that's not a recipe for success. Like, if you want to play the Nets-Knicks first round from a Nets side, you want that to be a home court in Brooklyn. And so I think the smartest thing, I think, you know, play well, get that fourth seed, get that home court advantage, and try to, you know, either whether it's the Hawks or whether it's Bulls, you know, take care of business as the Brooklyn Nets, not as a team that happens to play in New York against the Knicks, you know?
Yes, totally agree. Yeah. More identity formed if you're playing a different team in that first round. I agree.
All right, I'm going to get to a couple of user questions because we had a couple people who wanted to ask you some things.
Sure.
First one comes from Sean Mondello on Twitter, and he wants to know if you see PJ changing the rotation in close games with, you know, whatever five on the floor.
As opposed to what we're seeing now, I guess he's wondering?
I guess, yeah. I mean, I think it was a general question of, you know, of PJ's performance as a coach.
Well, I think that, you know, PJ's kind of trying to feel things out. As far as, look, he has three obvious answers for the closing five on the floor, and that's Brooke, Darren, and Joe. We know that. You know, if you look at the other spots, you know, we can all sit here and say, like, oh, why isn't he playing that guy? Why isn't he playing this guy? Why? Has anyone really stepped up and made it obvious for him, though? You know, and I think he understands that he's using this time to try and get a feel for which lineup is actually going to perform the best. You know, PJ is a guy who does look at lineup number success. I know some people don't think that he's like that because he's an old school guy, but he does look at lineup number success, and I think that he's just trying to get a feel for it. I like Mirza Teletovic's game. I like the way he spaced the floor, but I have to be honest, when he got his shot in the rotation, he didn't wow. He didn't make it obvious. And so I think because of that, PJ thought, you know what? I got to give Hump another chance here. You know, Humphrey started out a couple of good games. He slowed down since. Now it's sort of back in flux. Now you wonder, okay, in the playoffs, Brook Lopez is probably going to see more minutes. So does that mean we'll see more Andre Blatch with Brook Lopez in the postseason, depending on the matchup? I think PJ is going to go based on matchup. I don't think at this point he has anybody who he's particularly tied to, like, oh, I'm definitely playing that guy, I'm definitely playing this guy. If there's one thing we've seen from PJ, he will ride in the fourth quarter whoever he thinks is going well that day and not worry about whether or not it's Brook Lopez sitting on the bench for the entire quarter or Gerald Wallace or whoever it might be. And remember, against Phoenix, he sat Andre Blatch for the entire second half because he didn't like his first half performance. So that's something I think as a fan you should want from your coach, is the willingness to just put in whoever he thinks is best at that time. And I think in fairness to PJ, in those three and four spots, the answers have not been obvious enough. Now, I think there's a good chance you could end up seeing, you know, a Keith Bogans and Andre Blatch along with Brook Lopez at the end of a game, or Gerald Wallace and Andre Blatch along with Brook Lopez at the 3-4-5. I don't think it's known right now, but I would think that you're going to see more Blatch-Lopez because Humphreys and Teletovic did not run away with the four spot. And Evans, of course, as well, who, you know, we've seen him with Evans, we've seen a little bit more offensive promise lately. You know, Chicago notwithstanding, those other games he started to clean up around the rim a little bit. If he can, it makes him so much more valuable. But I just think at this point it's tough to know. Like, if I told you, Devin, what's the five that needs to close the game? Do you have an answer?
No, I don't. The only thing I can say is I'm with you that Brooke, Aaron, and Joe have to be out there. That's actually one of the things, you know, because Brooke has sat more fourth quarters than I think I expected at the beginning of the year. There was that stretch, I think, in February where there were about four or five games where Dre played pretty much the entire fourth quarter. And it worked, surprisingly, most of the times, because, you know, there is no logic to Andrew Blatch's game. I do think, you know, I think that those three should be out there. And, you know, I was a big fan of Bogans, but Bogans has really struggled these last couple weeks to score. And, you know, to me, what I find interesting about it is that PJ has been very clear that he likes to go big. And
right.
But he hasn't really done that with play. He hasn't played Blatch and Lopez together as much as I would expect, given how much he said, you know, I like going big. So I'd be very interested to see, because maybe that's something where he wants to really showcase that in the playoffs. And I think that's something where there's an advantage there, because if you have 2 7-footers who can score, you know, there's not a lot of teams that can defend that. You know, Chicago is very good defensively, but that's something they would struggle with. Atlanta, I mean, you know, you make Josh Smith work on the defensive end, he's just going to want to shoot jumpers in the offensive end. That's exactly what you want when you're playing Atlanta. You know, they're two very talented offensive players, Blatch and Lopez, and playing them together, you know, that might be something that we're not going to see a lot of until the playoffs, because, you know, that's a combination that TJ really, it seems like he really wants to play, but he just hasn't played as much as you might expect.
Yeah, maybe he is saving it in some senses. And the other thing is, you know, Blatch spaces the floor far better than Humphreys or Evans, obviously, too. And I think it'll just make it easier for Lopez to operate. So you might even see, you know, you might end up seeing a little bit more offense, defense down the stretch, too. You know, that can happen more in postseason games. But I think the key is we have not gotten an obvious answer at the 3 of the 4 spot. So we might as well continue to try things out here, right? I mean, that would be the thinking from the Nets. You know, as a fan, have you gotten an obvious answer, the 3 of the 4 spot? No, you haven't. So figure out these last few games, see if anything jumps out to you. And you're right about not playing small. You know, PJ has liked to play big. The interesting thing is he's played small at times, but he usually has more to do with a, you know, Marshawn Joe and Darren, or a CJ Darren Joe, rather than a Gerald at the 4. You know, I wouldn't mind seeing Gerald at the 4 a little bit here. That should be something I think that we get a taste of down the stretch, just to get an idea, since nobody else has run away with the power forwards position.
I agree, and the only, because one of my big things this year is to play Gerald more at the 4. But I do acknowledge that one of the issues with that is that Gerald is physically, you know, he throws himself everywhere, and, you know, he's at a point, he's on the wrong side of 30, and if you put him in a position where he has to bang so much, he's going to be, you know, by the end of the first round of the playoffs, he might not have a body anymore.
That leads into the second question,
the second fan question from CDesi79 on Twitter, which is, why is Gerald Wallace struggling so much?
You know, I think that Gerald is banged up. Like, if you remember the beginning of the year, Gerald, I remember watching and feeling like, you know what? Gerald Wallace is so underrated. He's such a good player. It's amazing if you can have him as the fourth best player on your team like the Nets do. Remember the double overtime game against the Pistons, the plays he made in that game? I mean, his shot has looked somewhat broken all year, but he still was finishing and contributing in more obvious ways earlier this season. You know, I think he got banged up enough and played through so much that he lost a little bit of the explosiveness that we were seeing earlier this year. And so I think that is why he struggled more than we're accustomed to. Look, he doesn't have a good-looking shot. He's not going to space the floor the way that you would like your 3-2. He basically can only hit a corner three. You know, occasionally he'll pop one from other places, but he just shouldn't shoot them. That's just not an efficient look for the Nets when they have as many options as they do offensively. And so I feel like it's almost like you got to tell him, hey, dude, if you're on the wing, I don't care how wide open you are, dribble it in. You know, instead of taking that shot, unless the shot clock's about to wind down, you know, you're being given 5 feet of space. Take advantage of it, because when you put it on the floor there and start going towards the rim, you're going to have a head of steam before anybody closes on you because of the gap they're giving you at the three-point line. So I feel like that's just got to be drilled into his head. Do not take the wide open wing three, because that's just not his shot anymore. But as for an answer why he struggled so much, I do think it's a product of him being banged up. And also, I think opposing defenses are giving us a chance to see where he's deficient offensively, because they realize how much attention they have to give to Joe, Darren, and Brooke. So it's okay. Where can we expose? Oh, here's an area, Gerald Wallace on the three-point line. So that combination, us putting more of a microscope on his offense because of the opposing defenses position, plus his being banged up, I think combines to where he struggled.
Gotcha. Yeah, I mean, I'm with you on all of that. It's tough. I mean, you saw in the first game of the season he went down with an ankle injury, and it's just, you know, it's hard to, you know, it's just the way he plays. You know, there's a certain, it's like written into his genetic code. He has to play one certain way, and it's, you know, it can be a detriment to his body, but without that, you know, the way he plays, he wouldn't be the player he is.
Yeah, if he can defend those opposing wings in the playoffs, then he will serve his purpose for this team. So you just hope he's healthy enough to be able to achieve that task.
Yeah, and I mean, there's wings that he's going to have to. I mean, I thought he played pretty well on Dang All Things Considered Thursday night.
Yeah.
And if they play the Bulls, you know, that's something that you would like to see him do. And then if they play the Hawks, I mean, I did probably have to switch him on to Josh a few times, actually. And if he can, you know, play the way Gerald Wallace can play for those kind of stretches of games, he's going to, you know, he's a very valuable member of this team. And it's just, you know, other than his very pronounced weaknesses, which are, like you said, shooting the ball, you know, he brings a lot of things that nobody else on this team can. And that's why, you know, that's why I think he's such a crucial part. That's why the Nets signed him, you know, within 30 seconds of being able to in July.
Yep.
We do have one final question, and this one is for me, because I, you know, the Nets and the Bobcats are playing tonight, and it's going to overlap with a couple of important NCAA men's basketball games. And I want to know, as far as, you know, Wichita State and Louisville, and then Syracuse and Michigan, what's your final four picks? Who do you have win the championship?
Well, I rely on people who know more than me when it comes to, you know, things that I don't follow as regularly. I'm a college hoops fan, but I couldn't break down the matchup for you. And all of my expert friends, if you will, have told me from jump that Louisville was the best team. Even before the tournament started, when it didn't look like there was, like, obvious one seeds this year and there wasn't an obvious best team, they all had said to me, no, 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 Louisville's the best team. Louisville's the best team. So I think ultimately Louisville is going to end up winning. You know, I think, yes, Trey Burke has some magic going on. And Wichita State, you get to the Final Four, you're not just some pipe dream Cinderella. They're clearly a good team. And I think Syracuse has something special going on right now, especially if you're a fan of disgusting basketball, because every game Syracuse plays because of that zone has become the biggest eyesore. It is hard to watch. It really is. But they have played really well. But ultimately, I think Louisville is going to end up winning this national championship.
I think that's fair. Yeah, they'll play at 6:09 Saturday night, and Michigan Syracuse played 8:49, and Nets Bobcats play at 7.
That's the game I will care about most tonight is Nets Bobcats. I will only be in a place where I can watch that in addition to the NCAA games. If they refuse, then I will be back in my apartment.
Well, for all of us, all of you guys still listening, go hop around bars in Manhattan if you want to try to find Ryan Rucco. And make sure that they're playing Nets Bobcats and the NCAA tournament, because that's how you'll find them.
That's
and
right.
Ryan, thanks again for coming on. It's been a lot of fun. I think you held up to the Iron Eagle hype. I think you also talked much longer than he did, but I mean, he's a star. He's got to go, preen himself, so we can't.
You know what? Here's the thing. I just have to learn how to be more efficient with my words the way that Ryan has. That's it. So, yes, still lagging behind Ian, but in pursuit perpetually to achieve his greatness.
That is actually a well put, a very succinct way to say it. We are in constant pursuit of Ian Eagle's greatness. That's just how it goes. Thank you again, Ryan Rucco, one of the voices of the Yes Network, voice of the Nets basketball. You can also find him on ESPN New York 98.7 with Stephen A. Smith. Anything else you want to say to our lovely fans of the Brooklyn game?
You know what? I have enjoyed reading you guys all year long, and I love being a part of this Nets community. And let's remember to enjoy this journey into the postseason. It's been a while, so it's okay to stop and smell the roses while also harboring high expectations.
I like that. Thank you again, Ryan Rucco. This has been the Brooklyn Game Podcast, Episode 2, and we will probably catch you who knows when. This has been 6 months since the last time we did one, so maybe sometime soon. Hopefully we will. Thanks very much, you guys.